Hi, this is Alan Chartok. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with former Republican Congressman and author Chris Gibson. Congressman Gibson's new book is Rally Point, Five Tasks to Unite the Country and Revitalize the American Dream. Chris Gibson, of course, is a former Republican member of the United States House of Representatives, representing New York's 19th Congressional District. He's been before these microphones many times. Gibson served in the House from 2011 to 2017 before redistricting in 2012. Gibson had previously served the 20th District. Prior to his congressional career, Gibson served as a colonel in the United States Army National Guard. Gibson was born in Rockville Center, New York, to Robert and Barbara Gibson, and he moved to Kinderhook, south of Albany, at a young age. Gibson was raised in a working-class family, was the first to go to college, paid for in part by his service in the National Guard. Chris Gibson rose from private to colonel in the Army, including combat command in the storied 82nd Airborne Division. His book, Rally Point, is his story about what he's learned from the School of Hard Knocks and how he's applied those lessons during his service in Iraq and in Congress. Currently, Gibson is the Stanley Kaplan Distinguished Visiting Professor of American Foreign Policy at Williams College. Welcome, Chris Gibson.
Hey, Alan. Great to be back with you. Thanks for this opportunity to really have an extended conversation. It really means a lot.
Or should I say, welcome, Dr. Chris Gibson, because a lot of people don't know you have a doctorate.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I do. But of course, you call me Chris, and I appreciate that.
And you call me Alan. And let me ask you this. What was your dissertation topic?
So I studied government at Cornell. My dissertation topic was on national security relationships and decision making. So in many respects, it sat at the nexus of domestic policy and international relations.
What do you mean nexus?
Well, it really where they come together, where they converge, because when you talk about national security decision making, we are talking about protecting America and Americans. But, you know, really, in a representative democracy, we have values. And among those are civilian control of the military. And how do we go about making sure that we balance liberty and security, that we don't forego one for the other? So these relationships are just vitally important to democracies. And so even though this is a story of national security, it's intertwined with domestic politics.
So give us one that really concerns you.
Well,
those in that nexus.
For example, balancing liberty and security. Obviously, I believe in protecting America. I fought and bled for this country, but it's because I believe in what we stand for. And that is our passionate belief in individualism, in supporting each other, in our obligations, in our private lives. So I believe passionately in the Bill of Rights, but I don't want to undermine those rights in the pursuit of security. So after 9/11, when we were obviously shocked, saddened, and angered by what happened, there was a move in our country to tighten up procedures that would help us keep safe. And among those efforts was the Patriot Act. But the problem with the Patriot Act is that it stepped on our civil liberties. You know, what was done in the pursuit of security compromised our right to be reasonably secure in who we are.
Give us specifics.
So there's two. There's two in particular that we overreached. And one had to do with what is called the business section record of the Patriot Act. In the business section, the government, according to the Patriot Act, is given authority to pursue activities, including investigation and surveillance, in cases where they're concerned about our security. So when you look at the law, and when I looked at it, and when they asked me to vote to reaffirm it, it said the government shall have the authority with respect to open cases. And I said, well, what's the legal definition of this? I mean, if they're allowed to conduct surveillance, for example, without a warrant, that's unconstitutional. And so the bottom line is that it is so ambiguously written that that was the clause, the business section clause, was the clause that was used to collect metadata on all of us. So
right. Yeah.
The government was listening to our conversations, going through our correspondence, because they had this authority attendant to the Patriot Act. That we have a time-tested process in this country that if the government, acting on our behalf, believes they have suspicion, they have to stand before a judge. They have to make a case for probable cause. If they can do that, the judge will issue a warrant, and then that allows the government to collect information. In the absence of that due process, the government is to secure our rights And among these are privacy. So that was the first problem with the Patriot Act, was the business section. And by the way, we all came to know that subsequently. When I took that vote, that was 2011. And I was taking a stand when some of my strongest supporters were kind of looking at me funny. They're like, why would you not support the Patriot Act? And I had to go through this dissertation, this explanation. But since that time, we had the Snowden case. And then, of course, we all came to know what was going on and that this metadata was being collected. And I think a lot of people now understand, I think, clearly.
So Snowden, let me just interrupt you, Chris. Snowden's great offense, of course, was that he took the data that had been collected and put it out there, right?
Yeah, and I don't, look, this is a very controversial topic. There's great emotion on this. I don't think that Snowden took the right decisions. I think that given his conscience and his concerns that he had for what happened, he would have been better off finding allies that could have worked with him if he'd reached out to members of Congress that could have advocated for him and the cause. That would have been better than to allow for all this information out in the public domain, which ultimately, in my view, and I know there's some listeners who really feel very strongly about what he did, but the consequences where we lost people who were trying to help America, their identities were revealed, we lost life on this.
And we know that for sure.
Yes, we do. But here's the point. The larger issue, the one of privacy for our country, for individuals, that you have to use due process, that is one that we should all rally around. That's the first problem with the Patriot Act. There was another problem, and that was what is often called roving wiretaps. So the argument was made that in this day and age, because of technology, that we can't really adhere to the last clause of the Fourth Amendment. The last clause of the Fourth Amendment says, with regard to warrants, that you need specificity in person, place, and thing. That is to say, Alan Shartok in the vicinity of the Kinderhook Library, because of this activity that he's doing on the internet, specificity, person, place, and thing. So the government's argument was, well, that's desired, but not necessary. It really shouldn't be the requirement because the way that SIM cards can be taken in and out of cell phones, and because of all this, just a general description for issuing a warrant is fine. Well, look, if you believe that, you got to change the Constitution then, because that is facially unconstitutional. There are things that are sort of argumentatively unconstitutional. That is to say, I say it's unconstitutional, you say it is, and then we debate this, the courts ultimately decide. And then there are things that are facially unconstitutional against the words of the Constitution. This is an example. Allowing for general descriptions for warrants is facially unconstitutional, and I would not vote to reauthorize the Patriot Act until that is revised. So that's an example where we talk about the nexus of domestic politics and international relations, and that in our country, we don't want to give up our liberty for security, that these have to be balanced. This is part of the message of Rally Point, because I believe these...
Rally Point being the name of Chris Gibson's very good new book.
And thank you for this opportunity for this extended conversation, because it's something I really feel passionately about, because I believe these principles do unify us. Because whether you be a committed progressive or you're a libertarian, you're conservative, you believe in these rights that we have and that government is not to trounce,
okay,
to trample them.
I want to stop you. I want to ask you this. You got out, you announced you're getting out, you did something that most congressmen don't do. You said, I'm only going to serve a specific number of terms. You actually got out a term before you said you would.
I said I would serve not more than 8 years.
Yeah.
And of course, six is not more than eight years.
Not more, but you did. Okay, great. And a lot of people respect that because term limits in this country are wildly popular, although politicians don't tend to support changing the rules so that they have to leave. Okay, but did you anticipate Trumpism at all when you were leaving?
Well, you know, I go through great length to explain what happened here. And, you know, it really stems from another widely held belief among Americans, whether they be on the right or the left. And that is the system today, both politically and economically, is rigged.
Isn't that the very word that Trump used himself?
It is.
Rigged.
But yeah. You know what? Whether you were at a Trump rally or a Sanders rally, what was one of the strongest applause lines is when these leaders, including Bernie Sanders, pointed out the fact that today in America, if you are not super wealthy or if you're not connected in any way, then the system doesn't work for you politically or economically. And so I'm not shocked to see what's happened here. You know, my issue is, you know, of course, being from New York, we know Donald Trump And we know he's been on the other side of all these issues over the years. So, look, you might say he was savvy, that he ran on a platform that a lot of people wanted to hear. They felt disaffected. You know, a fair number of the issues that he was a proponent for, I support. For example, reaching out to working class families. I came from one. I was first Republican ever in my family, and that was one of the things I fought my party on.
Where did you go wrong?
Well, I mean, I don't know that I went wrong. I mean, I think I stayed true to the values. But let me just say that for Trump, I mean, that was one thing, I think, that allowed him to break the so-called blue wall. So this argument for draining the swamp, I think it's widely popular. Well, an issue is they've accomplished nearly nothing on that score. So I think that we should hold him accountable for the pledges that he made. Not just that, though. He said he would focus on wages and on jobs. And I think that helped him attract working class Democrats to vote for him. So we got onto this part of the conversation because of the issue of the system being rigged and what to do about it. And I think now that what we need to do is hold President Trump accountable for the pledges that he made, and also hold him accountable for the things that he is doing or advocating that are unconstitutional.
The book is Rally Point, Five Tasks to Unite the Country and Revitalize the American Dream. Hey, Chris Gibson, wildly popular around here, but you quit the Congress and now you're teaching at Williams College and by all reports doing extremely well.
Love the job.
Quite popular. So I wanted to ask you this. Usually when a politician writes a book, it means he's going to run for something. And there are those people who have said to me, I think this guy wants to be president of the United States. Is that true?
I want to change the direction of the country. That's for sure.
Well, that sounds like you're really saying, yeah, I want to be president so I can change the politics of the
country. You can make a difference in this country in so many ways. One of them is elected office, and I may run for office again.
Which one?
Well, we'll see. You know, I wouldn't rule anything in or out.
That means you're running for president.
It doesn't mean that.
Oh.
It does mean that I feel very passionately about the country. And I think that, you know, these points I bring forward in Rally Point, which are actually derived from common sense and listening to folks, you know, I think that this can be the framework for us to unite and to really to revitalize and move forward. So when you look at my experience in the military, the thing about military leaders is they are developed over time and they move to higher positions of authority in both command and staff. I feel very comfortable as a candidate, as a leader, as a commander, but I also feel very comfortable as a member of staff. So when I feel very strongly about these views, I would feel just as comfortable being a candidate for higher office as I would helping a man or woman I believe deeply in, that really I think has the right ideas and the right approach. So as to what happens for us in the future, Alan, I would tell you this. I have commitments, obligations that take me through the summer of 2019, both family commitments. Our son graduates from high school that year, and we've made, my wife and I, Mary Jo, we've made a commitment to love and support him, to help him through that. And then the other piece of this is I'm signed on with Williams College until the same time, until June of 19.
Well, if you ran for president, I don't think even Williams College and its vaunted, looking down the hill way, would mind you running for president if you were working there, would he?
Well, I think if you're going to be a candidate for higher office like that, you really got to go all in. So, you know, if I do anything in the future, whether I run for any kind of federal office, state office, or if I help somebody in a federal office, working for a federal or a state office, in either case, I would be all in with that.
Okay, now look, everybody knows the story, at least I do. You may have made a mistake in telling me this, and maybe I'm not supposed to talk about it, but you were interested in being governor of New York. And you went around and you talked to an awful lot of the old hack political politicians. Those are my words, not yours. And, you know, they said, nah, you know, we're going to go with some guy who can self-fund or somebody who's lost before and let him lose again. Were you disappointed in that?
No, I was not disappointed. I mean, I actually had a very good experience. I made it to 46 of the 62 counties. When I say made it to, I really made it to just about every county, but I did public events in 46 of the 62 counties. So I really felt like I got a good look under the hood, and I really enjoyed it. I met people, yes, a lot of Republicans, but I met a fair amount of independents and Democrats, too.
Yeah, but what about those bums who didn't want to give you your chance and say, okay, you know, he's not the same old, he's got a lot of points that he makes in his new book, Rally Point, but I don't get it. These are the old politics. You're a bright young guy, did amazingly well in your congressional seat. What seems to be the problem that those guys said no to you?
Well, you know, they didn't really say no. My assessment was I would have to work 7 days a week for 2.5 years to have a 50-50 shot at being governor. And when I weighed that against my family obligations, most specifically my son, I didn't think that was the right decision. I thought what I needed to do is what I did, which is take a step back. You only get one chance when, you know, your son or daughter is coming through high school. And then once they're gone, they're gone. So I think I made the right call. And as to what happens going forward, we'll have to wait and see on that. As far as the Republican Party's chance, I wouldn't rule it out. You know, I think my party still has a chance to beat Andrew Cuomo in 2018. You know, we've got some fine folks, not widely known. I know that the chances here are...
And not without $27 million in their bank accounts.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, but I'll tell you, here's the thing. I think that things are changing in American politics. That's not to say money is not important. Of course, we know it is. I do think we need significant reform. I argued that in Rally Point. Among the many points, I think we need campaign finance reform of the right kind.
What's the right kind?
Well, I mean, first of all, we should have caps on congressional races. I don't think we should have unlimited spending. There ought to be a cap, and there have to be an algorithm to do that because no two media markets are the same. I think that you
should. And also, the Supreme Court of the United States might not let you do it.
Well, I think the other point is you'll need a constitutional amendment because every time we've tried to do these kind of reforms, they've been eviscerated in some kind of landmark decision. So I do think you'd need an amendment to the Constitution, but then you'd cap all expenses, you would report all donations, and here's the big move. We should prohibit all outside spending, all of it. Absolutely, super PACs, they're a problem, but also all PACs.
So that would be, as you say, need a constitutional amendment because the Supreme Court of the United States has said, hey, that's freedom of speech. They can do whatever they want.
Well, let me just say this, and I respect all viewpoints, obviously, but this is not free speech. This is very expensive speech. As having somebody who's been through it, I had $20 million poured on my head over the course of three campaigns. And it was nearly all negative, and it came from every corner and dark places, the money that, and look, I know that it was on, it's on both sides as well, but this is not free speech. In fact, I don't have a problem at all if the Koch brothers or Soros, if they want to stand on the corner with a sign, I wouldn't stop that for a minute. If they want to write a letter to the editor or do a blog, that's fine. My issue is when you see over 98% of the political donations coming from less than 200 people out of a country of 320 million Americans, that's wrong. It certainly calls into question the idea that we are a country of one person, one vote. You have to call that into question when you see such a symmetry when you talk about the impact of all these donations. So I think we do need to address this. But we got on this point because of the Republican chances. Look, money is a problem for the candidates, but it's not the only thing. That's one of the positive potentials of social media. You can reach people now in other ways. And, you know, we'll have to wait and see. Look, I think if we can get a candidate out there who works hard and is honest and transparent and focuses on two points, and that is opportunities, you say the economy, opportunities, and then anti-corruption. And then, because, you know, Chris Cuomo is going to try to make the race about social issues and everything else where most New Yorkers don't want to see significant changes when it comes to abortion and a lot of other issues. So, of course, he's going to try to label the Republican candidate as some kind of, you know, social conservative. If our candidate, Republican candidate, can make the campaign about the issues that the people of New York want to see addressed, which is opportunity and seeing rising wages, and then also seeing transparency and a clean government. If those are the two issues that voters have top of mind when they go to the voting booth in November of 2018, there'll be a Republican governor that'll be sworn in January of 2019.
Well, we've seen it before. George Pataki beat Mario Cuomo. Of course, it was his fourth try at political office. But you mentioned it, so therefore I think it's fair game. The A word, abortion, you're pretty well against a woman's right to have an abortion, right?
Well, where I've always been is, look, in a perfect world, there wouldn't be any abortions. We don't live in the perfect world. We live in the real world where developments happen. And so because of all that, I think it should be a private choice between a woman and her doctor. But I also believe this. I believe that we shouldn't use taxpayer dollars for abortions. And I also believe that what the science...
Why not? The poorest people won't be able to afford an abortion.
Well, let me make these 2 points, and then we certainly can go into any direction you want to go.
Do you think I'm and bullying that, you and not letting you finish your sentence?
Oh, I just want to finish this point. I mean, I don't think we should use taxpayer dollars for abortion, and I'll explain in greater detail in a second. And the second is the science. The science is pointing to the fact that fetus now, we have babies that are surviving early birth at 21 weeks. So I think when you look at the social contract for America, the Declaration of Independence, that we have God-given rights that are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I think when science points to the fact that babies are living at 21 weeks, that I think late-term abortion, you know, limiting for the purpose of the baby at 21 weeks, I think is the right place to be. So I think in the first 20 weeks, I think it's a private choice between a woman and her doctor. But I think once the fetus, once that baby is viable to live on its own outside the womb, I think that the government should secure that right. So now you were asking about funding. I mean, look, here's the point, is this is a highly emotionally charged issue, and I respect at all points of view. When I was a representative, this is probably the most difficult issue to represent because there are so strongly held views on both sides. And so I've just outlined to you how I handled this issue as a representative. And I believe that by not funding with taxpayer dollars, I think that I didn't make either side completely happy, but I did address the issue in a thoughtful manner that best represents how to move forward in America today.
But it's unequal. In other words, if a poor person can't afford an abortion, and you're for not allowing government funds to be spent in the same way they are for other health care issues, you know, basically you're discriminating against those who have the least.
Except for that isn't really true in reality, because the fact of the matter is that there are many in America who believe strongly in providing for funding for people who are in a social economic disadvantage. And so you see private donations to, for example, Planned Parenthood actually have went up in the last 5 years. And so there are resources available for folks that are in an economically challenged situation that they can get access to an abortion if that's their choice.
I think that's a weak argument, Chris.
No, it's not. I don't believe that at all.
Well, let me just finish. I am a great fan of yours, as you know. I've always been a great fan of yours. But I think if you're saying we'll pay for an appendix attack, which is a healthcare issue, but we won't pay because I don't want you to for, you know, funding an abortion, I think that you're saying the rich will out and the poor will not.
Well, look, I think my position is backed up by the facts, which shows that there's an extensive amount of private donations that go to Planned Parenthood for this reason. And
well, but Planned Parenthood can't possibly compete with the largesse of the federal government. I mean, look, I'm a huge fan of Planned Parenthood, but you can't say that Planned Parenthood will take up the slack because they can't possibly.
Well, Alan, when you consider how strongly people feel on both sides of the aisle, I think my view that on the matter of this private choice between a woman and her doctor, that should be paid for with private funds.
Okay.
So, and we can disagree on this. And I, like I said earlier on in our own conversation here today, I have said that I know that there are very strong views on both sides of this issue. And I think a leader's responsibility is to listen and to be aware and to certainly be conscious and empathetic with all points of view, and then to find a way that we can move forward, not making everyone happy, that's to be sure, but trying to find a way that we don't break down the cohesion and the comity of the country in the process.
So, and you said comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y.
Exactly.
I just didn't want to get anybody with a misimpression of this. Look, there are two United States senators, Senator Corker and Senator Flake. They're both conservative Republicans, and they both have stood up now and said in no uncertain terms, this guy, Trump, is no good for this country. He's disgraced the presidency, basically. You have John McCain saying much the same thing, and you have the former president of the United States, George W. Bush, saying the same thing. Obviously, I have to ask you about that.
Well, first of all, I've been vocal myself. You read Rally Point, and you'll see that I have an unfavorable view of Donald Trump. And being from New York and being a curious lad, I do a lot of research. So I have watched the videotape of Donald Trump emphatically being on the other side of all the issues that he says that he is the leader on now. There is a videotape of Donald Trump, for example, saying, he didn't just say very, because that's not good enough for Donald Trump. He said, I'm very, very pro-choice. That was Donald Trump on video. On page 102 of The America We Deserve, Donald Trump says he's for the gun ban. I could go on here. The point is on some of these most emotive social issues where Donald Trump claims to be the only one who can lead, he's actually on video on the other side of the issue. So, you know, to the point where you look at Corker and Flake. Flake, I've known. I mean, I served in the U.S. House with then Representative Flake, and he's a very thoughtful, principled person. And he feels very passionately about the views that he has. I can understand his frustration. And as I've said, not only in Rally Point, but I've written a series of op-ed pieces myself in the last 3 or 4 months where I've thought Donald Trump has really failed us as a leader. I called it out after Charlottesville, for example. So I think it's a leader's responsibility. And by the way, leader in this case, I'm going to say this broadly defined. You know, when we brought forward a government of the people, by the people, for the people, the office of citizen is among the most important in the world. So, you know, when we signed on for self-governance, what we agreed to do is not just vote, but to express our views to our representatives and to hold them accountable for what they said out loud. Because, you know, I had people come up to me and say, well, you know Donald Trump. I mean, he said this, but you know he's been on the other side of the issue. And I said, well, yes, that's true. But he said these things out loud in a campaign, and so now we're going to hold him accountable for what he said. You look at some of the things that he advocated for at his Gettysburg Address. Trump gave his own Gettysburg Address in October of 2016. He said he was going to, on his first day, he said he was going to bring forward an amendment to the Constitution for term limits. Now, I don't know what day this is, Alan, but it's not the first day, and we've yet to see that. I want to see him follow through on his pledge. As you point out, it's widely popular. He said he was going to help bring back jobs, help rising wages. He's been a proponent for infrastructure revitalization. Once again, just like with term limits, this poll's 75 to 80% popular, yet it's not done. You know, and here we have unified Republican government. I could go on. 3 or 4 of the major items of Trump's campaign are widely popular. I just mentioned 2 of them. And yet we've not seen anything enacted. So you can understand the frustration of anyone, including Corker and Flake and McCain.
There are many people who think the guy is nuts. And psychiatrists and psychologists have signed these manifestos which say he's guilty of this narcissism or something else. Do you think that's appropriate?
Well, I'll tell you, it's way outside of what I can comment on. I do have a doctorate, as you pointed
political
out, but
science.
I'm not a psychiatrist. And, you know, I'm not a medical doctor either. So I would
From your impressions, do you think he's nuts?
Here's what I think you do. As citizens, with rights and responsibilities, I think as for citizens, our responsibility is to hold them accountable for pledges and for the judgment. So I have spoken out. I have been concerned about his approach on international affairs, including North Korea. And
what would you do on North Korea?
Well, as I put it in a piece for the Times Union, the Albany Times Union, I think the key is China. And I know that's been said before, but I think what we can't order China to do anything. They're a sovereign nation. I think what we need to do is find a way to make it in their interest to support our goals. Our goals, I think you can get to a win-win-win. And I want to add not only the U.S. and China in there, but North Korea for 3. And for us, we want to make sure that the nuclear program is stopped, that it's reversed, and that they stop making threats to their neighbors, for example, Japan. So that's a win for us. What's a win for China? Well, when you take a look at the strategy of President Xi, and you see he has this very aggressive one belt, one road strategy, which not only is to help China reach its potential, but to help its friends and neighbors in the region. I'll tell you, a lot of what they want to get done would actually be good for the United States as well. They're looking to improve the infrastructure, the road network towards Europe. You know, they're looking to bring in closer relations for trade, exchanging of goods all throughout the world. These things are going to help the United States as well. So what are they short on? Well, they're short on the capacity of energy, and they are actually concerned about the ability to feed their people. So what they have done is there's a lot of focus in the world about their activities in the Spratly Islands and places like this. This is related to what China describes as their 9-dash line, which is an attempt to move what their territorial boundaries are to places like the Spratlys, and the purpose of which is because if they can be successful, then what's internationally recognized is an additional 200-mile economic exclusion zone. But what is it really all about? I've told folks who are involved in these negotiations is don't get caught up in the boundaries and economic exclusion zones. It's what they're trying to get access to within that. What they're really trying to do is get access to the natural gas that's in the South China Sea and the fishing. So if we know that's the true intent, well, then perhaps we can find a way that we can meet some of that interest, that some of that desire, without allowing them the whole 200 miles. So, you know, of course, they were taken to court. China was taken to court by the Philippines and others, but Philippines led the court case, and the Philippines won. An international tribunal found for the Philippines that China had overreached and was conducting illegal activity. So, you know, my point to you is that if we know that what they were really after was the fish and the natural gas, well, if we can work with the Philippines and Vietnam to find a way that they don't get the whole 200-mile economic exclusion zone, but there may be places within the South China Sea that they would be given primacy for, if we do that to advocate on behalf of China, who is already lost in the world court, if we do that to help China, would China, in a quid pro quo, use its leverage with North Korea? Let's keep in mind that China provides over 85% of the energy for North Korea. It's the nearly 100% of the financial services background and support for North Korea. That $2 billion of North Korea's GDP comes from people from North Korea who work in China and send 95% of their money back home. China has enormous leverage. China can make this situation get resolved. So if we help China, will China resolve this issue? So I've just given you now a win-win. Where's the win-win-win? Where's the three wins? So for North Korea, they would have to give up their nuclear program with verification, a regime that would also include the United States, China being part of that verification process. They would have to give up that program and stop making threats to Japan and other folks. So they'd have to give up something, but what would North Korea get in return? Well, the first of all is if they're party to this resolution. In a sense, we've given de facto recognition to the regime. That regime feels very insecure. They obviously act very insecure. This would give them some security. The other piece is they would get access to markets and international support that would help them, and they clearly need help feeding their people, for example.
Okay, so Congressman, Colonel, Professor Chris Gibson is with us now. He's written a great new little book, Rally Point, Five Tasks to Unite the Country and Revitalize the American Dream. Let's stay on North Korea for a little bit, Chris. I mean, we have a president who is not making any bones about the fact that the way to handle them may be war. And that's got to be very dangerous. You're a military man. You've commanded troops. You know what this is going to involve. What would a war between the United States and North Korea look like?
Well, it's unthinkable in this way that a nuclear exchange, no one would win. No one. So why would it be in anyone's interest to pursue something when you're going to lose?
So think like the president. What might he be thinking?
I don't know what he's thinking, to be candid, and I have spoken out. That's why I published. I feel very passionate about this area, and so I wanted to make my views known. And by the way, his Secretary of Defense and his Secretary of State both have said that we're never out of time to pursue a diplomatic solution. Mattis said explicitly, there's always time for a diplomatic resolution. So that's the first piece of this, is that a nuclear exchange ends up with everyone losing. That's number one. Number two is, even short of a nuclear exchange, we know that there are tens of thousands of artillery pieces in North Korea that are sighted on Seoul that are within maximum effective range and that would kill millions of people in that city. This would be a humanitarian crisis of the first order. It would have an eruption on the economies of Asia, which would absolutely have a deleterious effect on the United States. So if we end up in a war, among all the downsides, and I've just listed several, I've talked about the loss of human life, I've talked about the humanitarian suffering and the tragedy that would ensue, let me also add a recession in the United States. So we saw what happened to our country when we went into recession. It causes social tumult.
And so why recession?
Well, because this would cause major dislocation of the markets and the economies in Asia, and we're inextricably linked to those economies.
And so certainly China has an awful lot of money invested. You didn't mention this before, but an awful lot of money invested in the United States. You know, their money, their well-being is here. It's not in
North
Korea.
Well, this is why, by the way, you're absolutely right. But this is why. So what's curious about all this is when I listen to folks like Steve Bannon, you know, Bannon points out, he says, look, we're getting a raw deal from China. I agree. We are getting a raw deal from China. And by the way, that happens to be another point that a lot of people in America agree upon, whether you be a Donald Trump supporter or if you're a Bernie Sanders supporter. But here's where I do disagree, I think, although we'll have to see, is I think the answer is to sit down with China and hammer out a bilat. I think, look, when you look at the international stage today,
a bilateral
diplomat,
us and them.
We should come to a comprehensive agreement with China. That agreement should address security writ large, including North Korea. It should also include trade. It should include intellectual property. It should include currency, or what we often call currency manipulation. It should include the environment.
And they want to do this. Why?
It's in their interest. Who gains more from this order than the United States and China?
Well, but they're still ripping us off right now. You know that intellectually and every other way. Why should they change that?
They have everything to lose if there's a war in North Korea. And if they don't sit down with us, I think...
Do they have the power to stop a war with North Korea?
I think that they can play a major role in influencing North Korea to back off of this precipice that they're on and to encourage them with lever to accept an agreement that would ultimately, I believe, open up North Korea to do much better than it is today. The big thing is, will the regime feel secure? I've laid out an argument where I think we can get there with a win-win-win. Let me say this on the China piece, because I think this is pivotal. I don't believe we're destined to fight China. I think China is a nation that is on the rise, but could, if you look at it from our vantage point, yes, they hold quite a bit of our debt. We should be concerned about that. But there's tremendous potential for the United States if we can get a fair deal with China. Not only will that help us with the security arrangements around the world, but it will also open up a market of 1.6 billion people. Can you imagine the possibilities of revitalized manufacturing in the United States, including potentially Apple doing more manufacturing in the United States and selling iPhones to 1.6 billion people in China? There's tremendous possibilities for us that we could see the kind of growth that we had in the 1950s and the 1960s. When I say growth, I'm not just talking about GDP. I'm talking about the burgeoning middle class that came after World War II, the rising wages that families like my own, a working class family, who when my dad was working and not laid off, we did okay.
Okay, but Chris, I want to go back to the China thing with you. It's very interesting. You're a military man. You studied all of this stuff. You taught at West Point. You know your stuff. The one thing we keep hearing about China, now this may be not right, but the one thing we keep hearing is that they can't come to an agreement which would somehow hurt North Korea because they don't want the South Koreans on their border. Is that right?
No, that's not right. I think the reason why China hasn't moved right now is because, candidly, we're misplaying our hand. And the fact is we're losing more than they are. When we have our leader say there's going to be fire and fury and, you know, what does he call him? Something fat little rocket man or something, whatever it is he's calling him. The fact of the matter is when the world sees this, they look and they say, well, that's unconventional, number one. Number two is their instinct is it's probably not wise, but they look to number three, results. So how are we doing? Well, not very well. So the fact of the matter is through all this posturing and verbal gymnastics, we actually look weaker because we make these statements and threats and nothing changes. So all we're doing is we're diminishing our referent power in the world. And so there's an old saying in politics, and it works in the United States and it works in the world. When your opponent is imploding, get out of the way. So China right now is really seeing that we're really faltering when it comes to dealing with this situation. So they're just happy to get out of the way. But the art of diplomacy now is to re-engage China and say, look, and I hope this is going on. It may be going on behind the scenes, by the way. I know Tillerson, you know, remember Trump tweeted against Tillerson saying, hey, you know, look at Rex. He's trying all this diplomatic and only one thing works with North Korea. I took that to mean that Tillerson is working overtime to try to work with the Chinese, work with the regional actors, including Japan, Vietnam, and certainly North Korea, to find a place where everyone can see the utility in coming to an accommodation. So, you know, for China, what we need to do is say, look, you may think you're gaining right now because we're losing more than anyone, but it isn't going to stay like this. And by the way, you don't want to see a war either.
And by the way, you're a historian, Chris Gibson. You've looked at this. I'm old enough to remember it all. You're not. I'm just kidding. But my question is, we had something called the Korean War, which was never resolved. They really knew how to fight. And the Chinese, of course, came in on their side. Now, I suspect that that was the old Mao China and is not the China of contemporary times. Do you agree with that?
Well, perhaps, but I would not want to underestimate the Chinese military formations, I think, are formidable, and we would be unwise to think otherwise. So when we think about what array of possibilities and capabilities are resident in China, including their military formations, we should respect them. But, you know, what I would tell you is that what I've learned from that period of history is how careful you have to be with your words. We had a sense of deterrence there, and Secretary of State Dean Acheson made a comment. He thought it was benign, but he actually laid out what was called the U.S. sphere of influence. He gave this at a major address. He left Korea out of it, and within a month, there was actually an aggression. There was an attack, and I looked
Words mean something.
Well, yeah. I mean, historians have looked at this, and it's hard not to see a correlation, if not causation, between the statement that was made by our Secretary of State and the act of war that closely followed. Let me give you one other example of how this can be so. And what I'm about to say, I know that this woman would push back, but I remain on my position on this. So on the 25th of July of 1990, April Glaspie was about ready to go on vacation. She was the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Keep in mind, at this point in 1990, we had supported Iraq in their war with Iran for 8 years, and really we were largely responsible for supporting the Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq. So, of course, Iraq was in pretty massive debt because of this war. They were in troubles economically, and so they thought the answer was what they called the 19th province. We know that as Kuwait. And so, you know, Saddam started moving formations, military formations near the border. He started making these rumblings he was going to attack. So Glaspie was on her way to vacation, but she accepted this meeting with Saddam Hussein. And in the transcripts, we know that she said, look, on your disagreement with Kuwait, we don't really take a position. She did say, look, we want to have this peacefully resolved. But when she said we really aren't taking a position, I think Hussein misconstrued. Now, here's a strategic, you know, Saddam Hussein, if anybody, in the last 100 years has shown some kind of incredible incompetence when it comes to strategy. I'll give you several examples. That's one of them right there. But I think that the words that diplomats use are very important. And I'm convinced from reading the cables, the transcripts, and some historians' account that we could have taken a stronger position. I think if our ambassador went in and said, look, know you're moving some forces down there, and know you're in some kind of conversation, but you need to know we will not accept any kind of military incursion in Kuwait. You need to know that. All of our support will end, and you're looking at consequences, including military consequences. I think if that message had been communicated on 25th of July, Saddam would have moved in another direction. And just as I mentioned, Acheson. So what am I really making a case for here? I'm making a case for very precise and long-term, long-view diplomatic engagement. And when you talk about North Korea, this is what the focus ought to be. It oughtn't be these 140-character tweets that are actually inflaming the situation and derailing what I think could be productive talks going on behind the scene.
December 7th, 1941, we were negotiating diplomatically like crazy with the Japanese representatives. It didn't seem to help. Words didn't seem to matter.
Well, yes, and there was a lot going on behind the scenes there. I mean, we made some decisions as it relates to resources months before that. Japan was going—
In China, yeah, right? In China, we said, get out of China, and we said a lot of other things to them. And they sent their guys over here to have negotiations with us, and then they sent the planes. So sometimes negotiations don't work.
Well, I would tell you that an undergirding of all of that is what I argue for in the book Rally Point. And that is that your position for any kind of negotiation should always be a position of strength. peace through strength. If you're not in a position of strength, you're probably not ready to be at the table. You need to set the conditions for any negotiation. If you haven't done that, you're going to lose, diplomatically lose. So, you know, this is why in the book I lay out specifics on how we ought to do this, how we ought to get ourselves back in the kind of posture that when we reengage diplomatically, we'll be taken seriously. I give not only examples in history when we've done this wrong, but I've given an example of when we've done this right. Let me illustrate. So in 1994, there was a lot of pressure, even domestically here in the United States, from the Black Caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus, on Bill Clinton for his lack of activity to ensure that the democratically elected leader in Haiti, Aristide, that he would be put into power. He had won. Most international referees had concluded that he had fairly won that election. And yet a military junta led by General Cedras had taken power illegally and kept it. And the Congressional Black Caucus was arguing to Clinton, look, this is racist. Why aren't you enforcing what is internationally believed to be the right outcome for this election? Well, Clinton eventually decided that, you know, these arguments probably have a lot of weight. So he engaged with Senator Sam Nunn, former President Jimmy Carter, and General Powell, pretty high level delegation, sent them to Haiti. Now, what Clinton had done while he sent them there is he had the world's most formidable military force. Remember, we were only 3 years removed from Desert Storm. There was an unbelievable overmatch in the field. We defeated the fourth largest military in the world in 100 hours of a ground war. Now, there was a six-week air war that preceded it. But the world was watching, and they knew that we had incredible, really asymmetrical military might if we needed to use it. We hope to never use it. Okay, so there is that as a background. And yet, here's this high-level delegation meeting with Cedras. And Cedras is like, no. Yeah, no, I'm not going anywhere. And Powell grabs him on the side and he says, look, here's what's coming. The United States military is coming, and they're coming this week. In fact, let me bring your attention to CNN. And on CNN at that moment, they had cameras at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where the 82nd Airborne Division was outloading, and they were loading on planes. And Powell looks Cedras in the eye and says, they're coming for you, and they're taking you out. Big surprise. Cedras said, on second thought, I think I'm going to leave. And he left. So my point to you is peace through strength strengthens the hands of diplomats. When one acts in a virtuous and right way, and here the world was lined up behind a duly elected person.
A duly elected left-wing person.
He was duly elected to be seated. And
I'm not saying he shouldn't have done it because he was left-wing, but I think that the United States has always been very careful about supporting people from the left.
Well, in this case, look, we ended up taking diplomatic activity that ultimately ended in a manner where the duly elected leader was seated, and it was without bloodshed. So my point to you is, in the book, we often learn from bad lessons when things happen when we say, ooh, let's not do that again. But there's also examples where when you strengthen the hands of diplomats, what I argue in the book is from peace through strength, once you have established a credible deterrent, by the way, it's not just the United States. Credible deterrence also means working with your friends and allies. This is the argument for NATO. I give an extended argument for why NATO is important and relevant in the 21st century. And for those conservatives who argue for staying out of collective arrangements, please note this, because I give this argument from the conservative perspective. Because look, we tried twice in the 20th century from the position of isolation to avoid a world war. Now that's a noble end, right? We want to stay out of war. That's what we really want. We tried twice using the method of isolation, and it failed us. We ended up fighting both times. So, you know, a pragmatist would say, let's try something different. Well, this collective defense can help us because we then serve as a credible deterrent. My point to you is this, is when we establish this position of strength that leads to negotiations, that's how we got on this topic, we can actually lead with our greatest strengths. Our greatest strengths? Our ideas and our people. Our ideas as enshrined in our founding documents. And then also commerce, trade, humanitarian action. These are our greatest strengths, in as much as we need the credible deterrence first to lead with that. This is what I passionately believe in. And, you know, I was having one interview about a month ago, attended to the book, and the person said, well, peace through strength, who could be against that? I said, well, we haven't been practicing it. I mean, we've either been for all war all the time, which seems like what we've been doing since 9/11, or we're for this sort of sense of utopia that, well, we don't really have to have strength. We can just wish it and we can have, you know, peace in the world. Well, we all want peace, but what is the best method to do that? I argue that in chapter one of Rally Point, I provide what I think is an extensive framework that'll actually instantiate it.
The book is Rally Point, 5 Tasks to Unite the Country and Revitalize the American Dream. We have about a couple of minutes. I just want to ask you this very quickly. I've been watching Trump with great dismay, the president of the United States with great dismay. And I am concerned that when, from the time he got elected, he showed tendencies which would lead us into a totalitarian regime or even a sort of a fascist regime, to use a word from the past. Do you agree with that?
I'm concerned about the authoritarian drift. I write about it in Rally Point. And one of the reasons why it's really resonating for me is folks I've known, in some cases, almost all my life, who I viewed as pretty temperate, very thoughtful views, said to me, look, you guys, I was still in Congress then, saying to me, you guys can't fix it. We need to give it to Trump. We need to give it to a strong man to fix. Any listener out there who holds dear liberty, as I do, should be very concerned about that. The history of mankind is that absolute power corrupts absolutely and will lead to the crushing of both liberty and prosperity.
So let me stop you right there, because here you are at Williams College. You're teaching leadership. You're teaching democratic values. And I'm wondering whether or not the institutions of government, the other institutions, the house you served in, have been standing up. We find basically a guy who I consider to be a bit of a traitor, Nunez, who is the chairman of the Investigations Committee of the House of Representatives, finding his way up to the White House. This is not a good example of oversight. Are the institutions that we set up in the Constitution of the United States working?
We need reform. And you know who it's up to? It's up to us. We the people. We are citizens. We have the oath of citizenship. And what we need to do is insist on draining the swamp. We need the term limits so that we restore this relationship between the people and our representatives. We need independent redistricting. We need campaign finance reform of the right kind. We need lobbying bans that are much more strict. And here I'm talking for members of Congress as well. And this should be in law. And we need to work to restore the separation of powers. The Congress willingly gave power to one person, to the presidency. This has happened over the last 70 years, but it's accelerated in the last 20. And this is what's torn us apart, because we were founded, that Constitution that helped bring forward where we are today, it was not only a compromise itself, but it was meant to drive peaceful evolutionary change. And we need to restore that relationship. This is key to us. So when you talk about, are these institutions standing up? They need our help, because those institutions count on us. So we have to insist on this political reform.
We're out of time. We've been talking to former New York Republican Congressman and author Chris Gibson and professor at Williams College. Congressman Gibson's new book is Rally Point, 5 Tasks to Unite the Country and Revitalize the American Dream. Chris Gibson, you've been a great friend to this radio station. You've been here a lot. We very much admire you, and thanks for taking the time to speak with us today. I'm Alan Chartok.
Thank you, and best wishes to all the listeners out there, too. Thank you, Alan.